It's high time somebody did something, said the woman behind the counter at the store where I usually bought my cigarettes. It was on the corner, a newsstand chain, papers, candy, cigarettes. The woman was older, with gray hair, my mother's generation. Did they just close them, or what? I asked. She shrugged. Who knows, who cares, she said. Maybe they just moved them off somewhere else. Trying to get rid of it altogether is like trying to stamp out mice, you know. She punched my compu number into the till, barely looking at it. I was a regular by then. People were complaining, she said. The next morning, on my way to the library for the day, I stopped by the same store for another pack because I'd run out. I was smoking more those days. It was the tension. You could feel it, like a subterranean hum, although things seemed so quiet. I was drinking more coffee, too, and having trouble sleeping. Everyone was a little jumpy. There was a lot more music on the radio than usual and fewer words. It was after we'd been married for years, it seemed. She was 3 or 4, in daycare. We'd all got up in the usual way and had breakfasts. Granola, I remember, and Luke had driven her off to the school in the little outfit I'd bought her just a couple of weeks before, striped overalls and a blue T-shirt. What month was this? It must have been September. There was a school pool that was supposed to pick them up, but for some reason, I wanted Luke to do it. I was getting worried even about the school pool. No children walked to school anymore. There had been too many disappearances. When I got to the corner store, the usual woman wasn't there. Instead, there was a man, a young man. He couldn't have been more than 20. "She's sick," I said as I handed him my card. "Who?" he said. Aggressively, I thought. "The woman who's usually here," I said. "How would I know?" he said. He was punching my number in, studying each number, punching with one finger. He obviously hadn't done it before. I drummed my fingers on the counter, impatient for a cigarette, wondering if anyone had ever told him something could be done about those pimples on his neck. I remember quite clearly what he looked like. Tall, slightly stooped, dark hair cut short, brown eyes that seemed to focus 2 inches behind the bridge of my nose, and that acne. I suppose I remember him so clearly because of what he said next. "Sorry," he said. "This number's not valid." "That's ridiculous," I said. "It must be. I've got thousands in my account. I just got the statement 2 days ago. Try it again." "It's not valid," he repeated obstinately. "See that red light? Means it's not valid." "You must have made a mistake," I said. "Try it again." He shrugged and gave me a fed-up smile, but he did try the number again. This time I watched his fingers on each number and checked the numbers that came up in the window. It was my number, all right, but there was the red light again. "See?" he said again, still with that smile, as if he knew some private joke he wasn't going to tell me. "I'll phone them from the office," I said. The system had fouled up before, but a few phone calls usually straightened it out. Still, I was angry, as if I'd been unjustly accused of something I didn't even know about, as if I'd made the mistake myself. "You do that," he said indifferently. I left the cigarettes on the counter since I hadn't paid for them. I figured I could borrow some at work. I did phone from the office, but all I got was a recording. "The lines were overloaded," the recording said. "Could I please phone back?" The lines stayed overloaded all morning, as far as I could tell. I phoned back several times, but no luck. Even that wasn't too unusual. About 2 o'clock, after lunch, the director came into the disking room. "I have something to tell you," he said. He looked terrible. His hair was untidy, his eyes were pink and wobbling, as though he'd been drinking. We all looked up, turned off our machines. There must have been 8 or 10 of us in the room. "I'm sorry," he said, "but it's the law. I really am sorry." "For what?" somebody said. "I have to let you go," he said. "It's the law. I have to. I have to let you all go. He said this almost gently, as if we were wild animals, frogs he'd caught in a jar, as if he were being humane. "We're being fired," I said. I stood up. "But why?" "Not fired," he said. "Let go. You can't work here anymore. It's the law." He ran his hand through his hair, and I thought, he's gone crazy. The strain has been too much for him, and he's blown his wiring. "You can't just do that," said the woman who sat next to me. This sounded false, improbable, like something you would say on television. "It isn't me," he said. "You don't understand. Please go now." His voice was rising. "I don't want any trouble. If there's trouble, the books might be lost. Things will get broken." He looked over his shoulder. "They're outside," he said, "in my office. If you don't go now, they'll come in themselves. They gave me 10 minutes. By now, he sounded crazier than ever. "He's loopy," someone said out loud, which we must all have thought. But I could see out into the corridor, and there were two men standing there in uniforms with machine guns. This was too theatrical to be true, yet there they were, sudden apparitions like Martians. There was a dreamlike quality to them. They were too vivid, too at odds with their surroundings. "Just leave the machines," he said, while we were getting our things together, filing out, as if we could have taken them. We stood in a cluster on the steps outside the library. We didn't know what to say to one another. Since none of us understood what had happened, there was nothing much we could say. We looked at one another's faces and saw dismay and a certain shame, as if we'd been caught doing something we shouldn't. "It's outrageous," one woman said, but without belief. What was it about this that made us feel we deserved it? When I got back to the house, nobody was there. Luke was still at work. My daughter was at school. I felt tired, bone tired. But when I sat down, I got up again. I couldn't seem to sit still. I wandered through the house from room to room. I remember touching things, not even that consciously, just placing my fingers on them, things like the toaster, the sugar bowl, the ashtray in the living room. After a while, I picked up the cat and carried her around with me. I wanted Luke to come home. I thought I should do something, take steps, but I didn't know what steps I could take. I tried phoning the bank again, but I only got the same recording. I poured myself a glass of milk. I told myself I was too jittery for another coffee and went into the living room and sat down on the sofa and put the glass of milk on the coffee table, carefully, without drinking any of it. I held the cat up against my chest so I could feel her purring against my throat. After a while, I phoned my mother at her apartment, but there was no answer. She'd settled down more by then. She'd stopped moving every few years. She lived across the river in Boston. I waited a while and phoned Mara. She wasn't there either. But when I tried half an hour later, she was. In between these phone calls, I just sat on the sofa. What I thought about was my daughter's school lunches. I thought maybe I'd been giving her too many peanut butter sandwiches. "I've been fired," I told Mara when I got her on the phone. She said she would come over. By that time, she was working for a women's collective, the publishing division. They put out books on birth control and rape and things like that, though there wasn't as much demand for those things as there used to be. "I'll come over," she said. She must have been able to tell from my voice that this was what I wanted. She got there after some time. "So," she said. She threw off her jacket, sprawled into the oversized chair. "Tell me. First, we'll have a drink." She got up and went to the kitchen and poured us a couple of scotches and came back and sat down, and I tried to tell her what had happened to me. When I'd finished, she said, "Tried getting anything on your CompuCard today?" "Yes," I said. I told her about that, too. "They've frozen them," she said. "Mine, too. The collective's, too. Any account with an F on it instead of an M. All they needed to do is push a few buttons. We're cut off. But I've got over $2,000 in the bank, I said, as if my own account was the only one that mattered. Women can't hold property anymore, she said. It's a new law. Turned on the TV today? No, I said. It's on there, she said, all over the place. She was not stunned, the way I was. In some strange way, she was gleeful, as if this was what she'd been expecting for some time, and now she'd been proven right. She even looked more energetic, more determined. Luke can use your CompuCount for you, she said. They'll transfer your number to him, or that's what they say. Husband or male next of kin. But what about you? I said. She didn't have anyone. I'll go underground, she said. Some of the gays can take over our numbers and buy us things we need. But why? I said. Why did they? Ours is not to reason why, said Mara. They had to do it that way. The CompuCounts and the jobs both at once. Can you picture the airports otherwise? They don't want us going anywhere. You can bet on that. I went to pick my daughter up from school. I drove with exaggerated care. By the time Luke got home, I was sitting at the kitchen table. She was drawing with felt pens at her own little table in the corner where her paintings were taped up next to the refrigerator. Luke knelt beside me and put his arms around me. I heard, he said. On the car radio driving home. Don't worry, I'm sure it's temporary. Did they say why? I said. He didn't answer that. We'll get through it, he said, hugging me. You don't know what it's like, I said. I feel as if somebody cut off my feet. I wasn't crying. Also, I couldn't put my arms around him. It's only a job, he said, trying to soothe me. I guess you get all my money, I said, and I'm not even dead. I was trying for a joke, but it came out sounding macabre. Hush, he said. He was still kneeling on the floor. You know I'll always take care of you. I thought, already he's starting to patronize me. Then I thought, already you're starting to get paranoid. I know, I said, I love you. Later, after she was in bed and we were having supper and I wasn't feeling so shaky, I told him about the afternoon. I described the director coming in, blurting out his announcement. It would have been funny if it wasn't so awful, I said. I thought he was drunk. Maybe he was. The army was there and everything. Then I remembered something I'd seen and hadn't noticed at the time. It wasn't the army. It was some other army. There were marches, of course, a lot of women and some men, but they were smaller than you might have thought. I guess people were scared. And when it was known that the police or the army or whoever they were would open fire almost as soon as any of the marches even started, the marches stopped. A few things were blown up. Post offices, subway stations, but you couldn't even be sure who was doing it. It could have been the army to justify the computer searches and the other ones, the door-to-doors. I didn't go on any of the marches. Luke said it would be futile, and I had to think about them, my family, him and her. I did think about my family. I started doing more housework, more baking. I tried not to cry at mealtimes. By this time I'd started to cry, without warning, and to sit beside the bedroom window, staring out. I didn't know many of the neighbors, and when we met outside on the street, we were careful to exchange nothing more than the ordinary greetings. Nobody wanted to be reported for disloyalty. Remembering this, I remember also my mother years before. I must have been 14, 15, that age when daughters are most embarrassed by their mothers. I remember her coming back to one of our many apartments with a group of other women, part of her ever-changing circle of friends. They'd been in a march that day. It was during the time of the porn riots, Or was it the abortion riots? They were close together. There were a lot of bombings then, clinics, video stores. It was hard to keep track. My mother had a bruise on her face and a little blood. You can't stick your hand through a glass window without getting cut, is what she said about it. Fucking pigs. Fucking bleeders, one of her friends said. They called the other side bleeders after the signs they carried, "Let them bleed." So it must have been the abortion riots. I went into my bedroom to be out of their way. They were talking too much and too loudly. They ignored me, and I resented them, my mother and her rowdy friends. I didn't see why she had to dress that way, in overalls, as if she were young, or to swear so much. "You're such a prude," she would say to me in a tone of voice that was on the whole pleased. She liked being more outrageous than I was, more rebellious. Adolescents are always such prudes. Part of my disapproval was that, I'm sure, perfunctory, routine. But also I wanted from her a life more ceremonious, less subject to makeshift and decampment. "You were a wanted child, God knows," she would say at other moments, lingering over the photo albums in which she had me framed. These albums were thick with babies, but my replicas thinned out as I grew older, as if the population of my duplicates had been hit by some plague. She would say this a little regretfully, as though I hadn't turned out entirely as she'd expected. No mother is ever completely a child's idea of what a mother should be, and I suppose it works the other way around as well. But despite everything, we didn't do badly by one another. We did as well as most. I wish she were here, so I could tell her I finally know this. Someone has come out of the house. I hear the distant closing of a door around at the side, footsteps on the walk. It's Nick. I can see him now. He stepped off the path, onto the lawn, to breathe in the humid air which stinks of flowers, of pulpy growth, of pollen thrown into the wind in handfuls, like oyster spawn into the sea. All this prodigal breeding. He stretches in the sun. I feel the ripple of muscles go along him like a cat's back arching. He's in his shirt sleeves, bare arms sticking shamelessly out from the rolled cloth. Where does the tan end? I haven't spoken to him since that one night, dreamscape in the moon-filled sitting room. He's only my flag, my semaphore, body language. Right now his cap's on sideways, therefore I am sent for. What does he get for it, his role as page boy? How does he feel pimping in this ambiguous way for the commander? Does it fill him with disgust or make him want more of me, want me more? Because he has no idea what really goes on in there among the books. Acts of perversion, for all he knows. The commander and me covering each other with ink, licking it off, or making love on stacks of forbidden newsprint. Well, he wouldn't be far off at that. But depend on it, there's something in it for him. Everyone's on the take, one way or another. Extra cigarettes? Extra freedoms not allowed to the general run? Anyway, what can he prove? It's his word against the commander's, unless he wants to head a posse, kick in the door, and what did I tell you? Caught in the act, sinfully scrabbling. Quick, eat those words. Maybe he just likes the satisfaction of knowing something secret. Of having something on me, as they used to say. It's the kind of power you can use only once. I would like to think better of him. That night, after I'd lost my job, Luke wanted to make love. Why didn't I want to? Desperation alone should have driven me, but I still felt numbed. I could hardly even feel his hands on me. "What's the matter?" he said. "I don't know," I said. "We still have," he said, but he didn't go on to say what we still had. It occurred to me that he shouldn't be using we, since nothing that I knew of had been taken away from him. "We still have each other," I said. It was true. Then why did I sound, even to myself, so indifferent? He kissed me then, as if now I'd said that, things could get back to normal, but something had shifted, some balance. I felt shrunken, so that when he put his arms around me, gathering me up, I was small as a doll. I felt love going forward without me. "He doesn't mind this," I thought. "He doesn't mind it at all. Maybe he even likes it. We are not each other's anymore. Instead, I am his." Unworthy, unjust, untrue. But that is what happened. "So, Luke, what I want to ask you now, what I need to know is, was I right? Because we never talked about it. By the time I could have done that, I was afraid to. I couldn't afford to lose you." 29. I'm sitting in the commander's office across from him at his desk in the client position, as if I'm a bank customer negotiating a hefty loan. But apart from my placement in the room, little of that formality remains between us. I no longer sit stiff-necked, straight-backed, feet regimented side by side on the floor, eyes at the salute. Instead, my body's lax, cozy even. My red shoes are off, my legs tucked up underneath me on the chair, surrounded by a buttress of red skirt, true, but tucked nonetheless, as at a campfire of earlier and more picnic days. If there were a fire in the fireplace, its light would be twinkling on the polished surfaces, glimmering warmly on flesh. I add the firelight in. As for the commander, he's casual to a fault tonight. Jacket off, elbows on the table. All he needs is a toothpick in the corner of his mouth to be an ad for rural democracy, as in an etching. Fly-specked, some old burned book. The squares on the board in front of me are filling up. I'm making my penultimate play of the night. Zilch, I spell. A convenient one-vowel word with an expensive Z. "Is that a word?" says the commander. "We could look it up," I say. "It's archaic." "I'll give it to you," he says. He smiles. The commander likes it when I distinguish myself, show precocity like an attentive pet, prick-eared and eager to perform. His approbation laps me like a warm bath. I sense in him none of the animosity I used to sense in men, even in Luke sometimes. He's not saying "bitch" in his head. In fact, he's positively daddyish. He likes to think I'm being entertained, and I am. I am. Deftly, he adds up our final scores on his pocket computer. "You ran away with it," he says. I suspect him of cheating to flatter me, to put me in a good mood. But why? It remains a question. What does he have to gain from this sort of pampering? There must be something. He leans back, fingertips together, a gesture familiar to me now. We have built up a repertoire of such gestures, such familiarities between us. He's looking at me, not unbenevolently, but with curiosity, as if I am a puzzle to be solved. "What would you like to read tonight?" he says. This, too, has become routine. So far, I've been through a Mademoiselle magazine, an old Esquire from the 80s, a Ms., a magazine I can remember vaguely as having been around my mother's various apartments while I was growing up, and a Reader's Digest. He even has novels. I've read a Raymond Chandler, and right now I'm halfway through Hard Times by Charles Dickens. On these occasions, I read quickly, voraciously, almost skimming, trying to get as much into my head as possible before the next long starvation. If it were eating, it would be the gluttony of the famished. If it were sex, it would be a swift, furtive stand-up in an alley somewhere. While I read, the commander sits and watches me doing it, without speaking, but also without taking his eyes off me. This watching is a curiously sexual act, and I feel undressed while he does it. I wish he would turn his back, stroll around the room, read something himself. Then perhaps I could relax more, take my time. As it is, this illicit reading of mine seems a kind of performance. I think I'd rather just talk, I say. I'm surprised to hear myself saying it. He smiles again. He doesn't appear surprised. Possibly he's been expecting this or something like it. Oh, he says, what would you like to talk about? I falter. Well, anything, I guess. Well, you, for instance.
Me?
He continues to smile. Oh, there's not much to say about me. I'm just an ordinary kind of guy. The falsity of this, and even the falsity of the diction, guy, pulls me up short. Ordinary guys do not become commanders. You must be good at something, I say. I know I'm prompting him, playing up to him, drawing him out, and I dislike myself for it. It's nauseating, in fact, but we are fencing. Either he talks or I will. I know it. I can feel speech backing up inside me. It's so long since I've really talked with anyone. The terse, whispered exchange with Ogden on our walk today hardly counts, but it was a tease, a preliminary. Having felt the relief of even that much speaking, I want more. And if I talk to him, I'll say something wrong, give something away. I can feel it coming, a betrayal of myself. I don't want him to know too much. Oh, I was in market research to begin with, he says diffidently. After that, I sort of branched out. It strikes me that, although I know he's a commander, I don't know what he's a commander of. What does he control? What is his field, as they used to say? They don't have specific titles. Oh, I say, trying to sound as if I understand. You might say I'm a sort of scientist, he says, within limits, of course. After that, he doesn't say anything for a while, and neither do I. We are outwaiting each other. I'm the one to break first. Well, maybe you could tell me something I've been wondering about. He shows interest. What might that be? I'm heading into danger, but I can't stop myself. It's a phrase I remember from somewhere. Best not to say where. I think it's in Latin, and I thought maybe... I know he has a Latin dictionary. He has dictionaries on the top shelf to the left of the fireplace. Tell me, he says. Distanced, but more alert, or am I imagining it? Nolite te bastardes carborundorum, I say. What? He says. I haven't pronounced it properly. I don't know how. I could spell it, I say. Write it down. He hesitates at this novel idea. Possibly he doesn't remember I can. I've never held a pen or a pencil in this room, not even to add up the scores. Women can't add, he once said jokingly. When I asked him what he meant, he said, for them, one and one and one and one don't make four. What do they make, I said, expecting five or three. Just one and one and one and one, he said. But now he says, all right, and thrusts his roller-tip pen across the desk at me almost defiantly, as if taking a dare. I look around for something to write on, and he hands me the score pad, a desktop notepad with a little smile button face printed at the top of the page. They still make those things. I print the phrase carefully, copying it down from inside my head, from inside my closet. Nolite te bastardes carborundorum. Here, in this context, it's neither prayer nor command, but a sad graffiti, scrawled once, abandoned. The pen between my fingers is sensuous, alive almost. I can feel its power, the power of the words it contains. Pen is envy, Aunt Lydia would say, quoting another center motto, warning us away from such objects. And they were right. It is envy. Just holding it is envy. I envy the commander his pen. It's one more thing I would like to steal. The commander takes the smile button page from me and looks at it. Then he begins to laugh. And is he blushing? That's not real Latin, he says. That's just a joke. A joke? I say, bewildered now. It can't be only a joke. Have I risked this, made a grab at knowledge for a mere joke? What sort of a joke? You know how schoolboys are, he says. His laughter is nostalgic, I see now, the laughter of indulgence toward his former self. He gets up, crosses to the bookshelves, takes down a book from his trove, not the dictionary, though. It is an old book, a textbook, it looks like, dog-eared and inky. Before showing it to me, he thumbs through it, contemplative, reminiscent, and then, here, he says, laying it open on the desk in front of me. What I see first is a picture, the Venus de Milo, in a black and white photo with a mustache and a black brassiere and armpit hair drawn clumsily on her. On the opposite page is the Colosseum in Rome, labeled in English, and below a conjugation. Sum es est. Summus estis sunt. There, he says, pointing, and in the margin I see it, written in the same ink as the hair on the Venus. Nolite te bastardes carborundorum. It's sort of hard to explain why it's funny unless you know Latin, he says. We used to write all kinds of things like that. I don't know where we got them. From older boys, perhaps. Forgetful of me and of himself, he's turning the pages. Look at this, he says. The picture is called The Sabine Women. And in the margin is scrawled Pim, Pis, Pit, Pimus Pistus Pants. There was another one, he says. Kim, Kiss, Kit. He stops, returning to the present, embarrassed. Again he smiles. This time you could call it a grin. I imagine freckles on him, a cowlick. Right now I almost like him. But what did it mean, I say. Which, he says. Oh. It meant, don't let the bastards grind you down. I guess we thought we were pretty smart back then. I force a smile, but it's all before me now. I can see why she wrote that on the wall of the cupboard, but I also see that she must have learned it here, in this room. Where else? She was never a schoolboy. With him, during some previous period of boyhood reminiscence, of confidences exchanged. I have not been the first, then, to enter his silence, play children's word games with him. What happened to her, I say. He hardly misses a beat. Did you know her somehow? Somehow, I say. She hanged herself, he says, thoughtfully, not sadly. That's why we had the light fixture removed in your room. He pauses. Serena found out, he says, as if this explains it. And it does. If your dog dies, get another. What with, I say. He doesn't want to give me any ideas. Does it matter, he says. Torn bedsheet, I figure. I've considered the possibilities. I suppose it was Cora who found her, I say. That's why she screamed. Yes, he says. Poor girl. He means Cora. Maybe I shouldn't come here anymore, I say. I thought you were enjoying it, he says lightly, watching me, however, with intent, bright eyes. If I didn't know better, I would think it was fear. I wish you would. You want my life to be bearable to me, I say. It comes out not as a question, but as a flat statement, flat and without dimension. If my life is bearable, maybe what they're doing is all right after all. Yes, he says, I do. I would prefer it. Well then, I say, things have changed. I have something on him now. What I have on him is the possibility of my own death. What I have on him is his guilt, at last. What would you like, he says, still with that lightness, as if it's a money transaction merely, and a minor one at that, candy, cigarettes. Besides hand lotion, you mean, I say. Besides hand lotion, he agrees. I would like, I say, I would like to know. It sounds indecisive, stupid even. I say it without thinking. Know what, he says. Whatever there is to know, I say, but that's too flippant. What's going on? Night, 30. Night falls, or has fallen. Why is it that night falls instead of rising like the dawn? Yet if you look east at sunset, you can see the night rising, not falling, darkness lifting into the sky, up from the horizon, like a black sun behind cloud cover. Like smoke from an unseen fire, a line of fire just below the horizon, brush fire, or a burning city. Maybe night falls because it's heavy, a thick curtain pulled up over the eyes, wool blanket. I wish I could see in the dark better than I do. Night has fallen then. I feel it pressing down on me like a stone, no breeze. I sit by the partly open window, curtains tucked back because there's no one out there, no need for modesty, in my nightgown, long-sleeved, even in summer, to keep us from the temptations of our own flesh, to keep us from hugging ourselves, bare-armed. Nothing moves in the searchlight moonlight. The scent from the garden rises like heat from a body. There must be night-blooming flowers, it's so strong. I can almost see it. Red radiation wavering upwards like the shimmer above highway tarmac at noon. Down there on the lawn, someone emerges from the spill of darkness under the willow, steps across the light, his long shadow attached sharply to his heels. Is it Nick? Or is it someone else, someone of no importance? He stops, looks up at this window, and I can see the white oblong of his face. Nick. We look at each other. I have no rose to toss. He has no loot. But it's the same kind of hunger, which I can't indulge. I pull the left-hand curtain so that it falls between us across my face, and after a moment he walks on into invisibility around the corner. What the commander said is true. One and one, and one and one doesn't equal four. Each one remains unique. There is no way of joining them together. They cannot be exchanged one for the other. They cannot replace each other. Nick for Luke, or Luke for Nick. Should does not apply. You can't help what you feel, Mara once said, but you can help how you behave. Which is all very well. Context is all, or is it ripeness? One or the other.
This ends side two of cassette 5. Please stop the tape before fast forwarding to the end and loading cassette 6.